Welcome back, Mindsetters. Welcome back to the fifth and final episode of Goolvy Scream Set Horror-tober, coming to you in November. Today, we are going to be talking about Life in the Big Shitty, or rather, two horror films that ponder that ponder urban life and the surus within. Hessa, what's your favorite thing about living in the big city?
I love that, you know, it's every day, it's the Big Apple, 1 minute takes 1 second, and there are people yelling at each other, screaming at each other. I like that there's no wolves running around. I like that there's definitely no Candyman. It's just two things I love.
My favorite thing about New York City, number one, the Yankees. Number two, the Mets. Number three, the Wolves. The Wolves, yes. We were talking, and my least favorite thing about the city of Chicago, number one, the Bears. Number two, the Bulls. Number three,
the
fucking Candymen. All the bees.
The bees, the Candymen.
The bees. Listener, on episode five of Goolvy Scream Set, we are talking about 1981's Wolfen, directed by Michael Wadley, and then 1992's Candyman, directed by Bernard Rose. Two films that, like I said, deal with some of the stressors of living in an urban environment. You know, the promise of the big city is that every day we wake again anew, that we can move here, we can live here, we can become new people, and we can transcend the weight of the past. And what these movies suggest is that, no, there is a wolf and a man with a hook on his hand around nearly every corner, yes. And that the past is never really gone, even in the gigantic technological industrial metropoles of America.
Yes, you can't hide.
So, to begin with, Wolfen from 1981, directed by Michael Wadley.
Orion Pictures presents Wolfen. For centuries, they have been hiding in the rubble of your cities. The concealed threat. The invisible terror.
Chris!
They can sense the rhythm of your blood. Hear clouds pass overhead. See where you are blind. A force so deadly, it will tear the scream from your throat.
Get out of there!
What do you think it was?
You were being lured. We were being separated.
By what?
The carnivore. You got yourself some kind of meat eater.
Meat eater.
What is it?
It's Wolfen. Gods. In their eyes, you are the savage.
Wolfen.
Here's where I want to begin with Wolfen and why I chose it. Because of two things. One, all of the absolutely real New York City locations.
Yes.
You've got the Battery. You've got the Manhattan Bridge. You've got the Central
Park
Zoo.
Brooklyn Bridge.
You've got Wall Street. You've got the Brooklyn Bridge. And best of all, you have parts of the South Bronx filmed in 1980 that look like Dresden after World War II.
Yeah, it's shocking.
Some major urban renewal going on in this movie. But my number two thing I'm choosing Wolfen for the real New York City locations, and all of the real actual wolves put in New York City locations.
Okay.
And let roam about free.
The wolves, at points in this movie, the wolves, I was like, that this wolf is scarier than any monster in any movie, because it's
there
just
is
like a real wolf.
That is what I love so much about this movie, because like we've talked a lot about in this show about practical effects, gore, and various frights and spooks, but to me, there is simply no substitute for a real—I don't know—about 100-pound dog snarling at
yes.
you. And actually, I shouldn't disrespect the wolfen by calling them dogs. They are all real wolves used in this movie. And I guess I want to begin with the most amazing fact I learned about wolfen in preparing for this episode, and that is, in the scenes where the wolves are running about Wall Street and down various streets, like there's a couple scenes where they use real wolves in New York City, and even like a real wolf pack. During the filming of these scenes, the NYPD had a ring of police snipers on rooftops as an insurance policy should any of the wolf actors decide to freelance.
Oh my God, that's so cool.
Now,
the wolves could have probably outsmarted them if they were wolfins, because they're a lot yes. smarter than people. I don't know if you knew that.
Cops love shooting dogs, yes. but shooting, as this movie shows, shooting wolfin is a little bit more difficult
prospect.
Than shoot. Yeah, it's a little bit more difficult than shooting the average perps house pet.
Yeah.
And it's a lesson our lovable, drunken, schlubby detective, Albert Finney, learns throughout this movie.
A classic New York guy. You could tell just by the way he talks. He acts, but he's yes. born and raised in New York City.
Just a couple of things about Wolfen. This is like... I'd say Wolfen is probably like the third in the triptych of major werewolf movies made in the 80s. I'm interested in, because like the werewolf explosion that took place in American horror movies in the 1980s, and like the other two most prominent, I'm thinking of John Landis's An American Werewolf in London mm-hmm. and Joe Dante's The Howling. And I always sort of interpret the werewolf in 80s movies, and particularly in American Werewolf in London, is being sort of an unconscious expression of the ascendance of the Reagan 80s, and the sort of the unleashing of the like predatory instincts of capitalism and American horniness on the world.
Yes.
However, in Wolfen, the wolves and the wolf and the wolf spirits in this movie represent something very interesting and different, and that's why I wanted to talk about this. And by way of talking about it, I want to mention the director of this movie, Michael Wadley. Now, kind of similar to our last episode, Michael Wadley is a guy whose IMDb credits are pretty threadbare. I think this is the only like feature film he ever made. But however, interestingly, his other major IMDb credit is that he did the Woodstock documentary.
Yes, he shot it, right?
Yes, he's a documentary filmmaker, and it's probably his most famous work is the Woodstock, the documentary about the 3 days of peace, music, and love. And what I find so interesting about his involvement in that, and then like really the meaning of this movie, is that in this movie, like I think like it really deals with the kind of end of the 60s and 70s counterculture, and the kind of backwash of radical movements, and yes, and the slide into like the Reagan 80s. But like what the wolves represent in this movie are something very different than like our predatory instincts, shall we say.
Yes.
The movie, and one more thing, the director of photography on Wolfen is Jerry Fisher, who was the same DP on Exorcist 3.
Yes.
So that's another crossover with the mindset. And I think you can really tell, Hesse, you remember like the early scenes in Exorcist 3 of like the streets of Georgetown, and how like sort of really like ambiently dreadful it all is?
Yes.
I think he really brings that same eye to bear on New York City in this movie.
It has the same spooky gravitas, kind of, when the, you know, when especially when we're looking through the wolves' eyes with the crazy predator vision.
Yes. Well, yes, Wolfen is also well known for the first movie to use in camera thermographic effects that create wolf vision that we later see used to great effect in John McTiernan's Predator. But you know, this is really kind of like this movie influenced Predator. And another movie that this movie has influenced is, did you notice that the score in this movie, composed by James Horner, did you notice that it's eerily similar, and some might say exactly similar, to the score he did but 8 years later for James Cameron's Aliens?
Oh my God, I didn't even pick up on that. That's so good.
Watch this movie again and then think about like the tank assault scene in Aliens, and like James Horner, I mean, wow, good racket if you can get it, just doubling down on film scores. No, but like this movie is about the return of these apex predators to an urban environment and the meeting of like the nations older than even the First Nations of this country.
Yeah.
Coming like sort of melding into our biggest, wealthiest technological metropolis in New York City, and melding and also coming face to face with the forces of urban renewal and gentrification.
Yes.
As this movie begins, we see the
Batman's parents horrific getting killed.
Yes. We see the Vanderveer husband and wife of, you know, rich coke addict real estate developers in New York City get butchered by an unseen force in Battery Park.
Yes.
Essa, one thing I love about the predator vision and the sort of wolfen effects in this movie is that, you know, unlike regular wolves and dogs, when these wolves hit you, your head or hand just flies straight off.
Oh, they cut hands off like nobody's business. Towards the end of the movie, when the guy's like reaching for his gun, and it happens again that a wolf literally just clean cuts his hand off with his mouth. I'm just like, fuck yeah. It's like a signature move for them.
So yeah, the movie opens with a grisly triple murder in Battery Park of like, yeah, this guy Vanderveer, his wife, and their bodyguard, and he's like a huge real estate developer in New York City. And then of course we have Albert Finney, our lovable, irascible, drunken Irish detective.
Yes, our marathon man, if you will. As he's training for a marathon with, you can't quite see it yet, but he has, his hair is what I could only describe in this movie as lunch lady hair. him, at several points, he looks like a lunch lady.
How about some more cream corn?
he arrives on the scene of this murder and, in full marathon clothes, and seems to really zero in on the fact that the bodyguard, the Haitian bodyguard, has a voodoo ring with a pentagram and a goat's head on it. And that seems to be like his entire angle of investigation for this.
And as soon as he drops the his voodoo clue, like his sort of harried boss says, "Voodoo? There's 80 goddamn sects in Manhattan alone." And so once again, it's like kind of similar to Halloween 3. This movie is like, you know, sort of like connecting the threads from like old darker, like the older mythologies of the past, and bringing them into like a very modern context. And like another way this movie establishes very early on the kind of the hand of the past reaching into the present is that these three murders take place at a recreation of the first windmill ever built in New York, right on the Battery by, you know, Dutch colonists.
Yes. There's a real anti-Dutch undertone to this. It's kind of like revenge on the Dutch. From, you know, native just wolf spirits that have been here for centuries and millennia.
And then, of course, we see the introduction of the other main character, or like the other, like the sort of sidekick character in this movie, the medical examiner / like city coroner, played by the great Gregory Hines.
Yes, Greg Hines.
I love him as like the cool medical examiner. You know, yeah. Get this guy on Law and Order. He's got one of like the dangly earrings. Unfortunately, yes. He doesn't dance in this movie.
I know. I was Gregory, like, what a waste to not give him a dance scene. At least give him like some kind of tap dance around like a wolf or something.
I wanted to see him try to like dance escape the wolf when it kills him.
Yes, exactly.
Just do a little leap, do some taps. I mean, Gregory Hines though is so funny. And for me, like one of the, like, I told you, I love all the New York City details in this movie. And for me, like, when I first saw this movie, the scene that really, like, opened it up for me is how much time they spend in, like, what I assume is a real or very realistic recreation of the city morgue. And just, yes, like, all the focus on the kind of, like, the bureaucracy of dealing with, like, dead bodies in New York City. And it's just, like, all these little details, like, they're trying to move a body, and, like, the rigger has, like, stuck the finger, like, holding on to the side of this slab, and they have to, like, break the finger and pull it off. There's just, like, you know, corpses in various stages of autopsy. There are, like, genitals, yeah, exposed everywhere. And then Finney and Hines, of course, like, they just have, like, I just love, you know, like, that realistic, totally nonplussed attitude to just, this, yes, like, a display of death everywhere.
Finney, in his, because he's still ostensibly training for a marathon at some point in the in nondescript future, he's carbo loading like crazy. So he's eating cookies in the morgue. He's, like, always eating, like, treats and snacks. And, like, even when they're, like, sawing into the bodies on the autopsy table and blood's going everywhere, he's just, like, you know, eating these little cookies out of a paper bag.
He's like me for real.
Yeah.
I mean, like, training for a marathon, and then in several scenes of this movie, like, just drinking Cutty Sark straight out of the bottle and smoking a dog turd sized cigar.
Yeah. A wolf turd sized cigar.
The NYPD is on the case, but, like, I think another interesting aspect of this movie is that, like, the first suspect that they have in these wolf murders is that they suspect terrorism.
Yes.
And they suspect terrorism because, like, Mr. Vanderveer's niece is in some kind of, like, Symbionese Limit Liberation Army, Patty, yes, Hearst-style terror cell.
She's full Patty Hearst, and basically Vanderveer's last name might as well be Chiquita Banana with the things they're explaining him doing, like, at the, yeah, beginning. It's like, oh, this is not really, as Albert Finney so wryly puts it, oh, friend of the third world, I see.
Yeah, he's opened up a lot of new condos in what used to be villages in El Salvador and Nicaragua.
Yes.
So, yeah. And then, like, the other interesting thing, like, in the way this movie, like, it deals with, like I said, the backwash of 60s radicalism, which at this point, it, like, you know, they weren't getting the new cool world that they thought they were. And, like, they'd either, you know, you either sell out and become, you know, a businessman. There's a great scene in this where Albert Finney is talking about, like, radical Native American activists. And he's just like, yeah, I might be one of the few radicals left that aren't making money selling Levi's now. But, like, in this backwash of, like, 60s radicalism turned into kind of Biedermeierhof-style terrorism, there's a German terrorist cell in New York City in this movie called Gotterdammerung, which I thought is great.
Yes.
But the movie also introduces, like, I guess, like, this sort of private corporation that, like, keeps track on terrorist groups. It's sort of like a private CIA that has, like, a lie detector room that they use.
It's like the RoboCop police organization, kind of. And they have this, like, weird technology that they're trying to use to analyze the Patty Hearst niece. And it's strange because, like, the way that it detects, like, heat and stuff is kind of similar to the wolf vision, but...
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, so there are, like, some strange parallels there, but they basically decipher that Patty Hearst is lying, and she did not do anything to her uncle.
Yeah, she's trying to claim credit for killing her uncle.
Yeah.
But they're like, yeah.
It's like the scene in Asayas's Carlos the Jackal, where they
yes.
try to blow up an Israeli plane, but they accidentally blow up, like, a Lebanese plane, and then they try to call it in. They're like, oh, someone else already took credit for that one.
Yeah. And, like, I it's just like, they, you know, it's sort of it's very sort of prescient in that, like, in this movie, counterterrorism has become, like, a privatized big business, and they're, like, assisting, yes, these schlubby New York cops who don't know shit about the world or terrorism or anything. But they introduce the character played by Diane Venora, who is this kind of, like, I don't know, like, CIA consultant.
Criminologist, kind of.
Yeah, she's a criminologist. And there's a great scene with, This is her first film appearance, actually, and you'll probably remember her from Al Pacino's wife from Heat and Russell Crowe's wife from The Insider. So she's a she's a man lady, Diane Venora.
Yes, she's a man lady.
And like he's eating, he's getting a hot dog on the street, and he's just like, what can you tell me about leftist terrorist groups and mutilation? And then she just rattles off this list of like, well, The Shining Path likes to cut off people's dicks and put them in their mouth. You know, the New Red Front has been known to cut toes off.
Yeah.
but yeah, like they're stumped by this murder until it shifts his focus from, you know, Wall Street and the downtown set to, as I said, the economically, socially, and architecturally blighted South Bronx of 1980.
Yes.
And Hess, I would just like to truly underscore for the audience here, like they built the set of the burned down church on like a real street corner that was already rubble. But pretty much like everything else in the South Bronx of this movie is just what it looked like.
That's so crazy. It looks like so like apocalyptic and insane.
It's like just like dozens of square city blocks that are just like totally burned down husks.
Yeah.
And then you see the Wolfen Vision, and they take another victim. And this time, unlike the richest real estate developer in the city, it's like a destitute junkie and wino just like wandering the streets of the South Bronx.
Yes.
And like the first clue is that like a hair links both of these bodies.
Yes.
And that this is the connection here. And then of course we bring in Tom Noonan, another horror movie heavy, another man.
Yes. The beautiful Tom
Noonan. Tom
Noonan
is the Central Park Zoo's wolf expert. And like he's an expert in predator behavior. And once again, like the past reasserting itself, like he, like a big part of it, like he talks about how like in the westward expansion and settlement of this country, we like nearly wiped out like every wolf in existence that lived in this country. And there were like millions of them at one point. And like, as this movie takes place, he says there's only like a handful left in the Rockies.
Yes.
So like, yeah, like for America to be civilized, we had to remove the other apex predators on this continent so that Europeans could move in.
Yes. And Tom Noonan is adamant that a wolf did not do these brutal killings, even though all signs kind of point to a wolf, because he's like, wolves don't really attack, they don't kill people like that, only people kill people like that. And he makes a huge point about it, and you know, he would bet his life on it, it would seem.
I hope he doesn't meet an ironic end.
Yes.
No, Dad, there's a horrible scene in this movie where Noonan is watching like a film reel of people shooting wolves from helicopters.
Yeah. That's
which is still done. And, you know, I got to say, people, I compared the earlier werewolf movies to like the American werewolf spirit of predation and bestial, like our bestial like id. I think a better comparison is just feral hogs, feral swine, because like that really is what man is. Feral hogs kill way more people than wolves ever have. And Tom Noonan is right. Wolves do not kill people. In North America, there is like absolutely zero recorded instances of wolves killing people. But there are probably millions of instances of people killing wolves.
Yes.
Once again, in both the movies we're talking about today, the monsters of both of these movies are thoroughly tragic and mostly, and Wolfen, I would say, entirely sympathetic.
Yes.
And in Candyman, merely somewhat sympathetic.
Yes. He's got a bit of a mean streak in him in Candyman. Yeah. But like they say in this movie towards the end, they tell Albert Finney, like, to them, we're the like beasts. We're the monsters. We're uncivilized.
Yeah. And like in the Noonan character is like, yeah, a predator did do this. Homo sapien, the worst of the whole lot. We are by far the worst predators on this planet. And like, they, even though they can't possibly believe a dog is doing this, they get their next suspect in the character played by Edward James Olmos, who is fantastic in this movie.
Uh-huh, he's amazing.
He plays like an ex-radical, like a radical Native American activist who has like just got out of prison, but currently has a job working on the High Steel. And this movie acknowledges a real phenomenon of like that many of the iron workers who do like the high steel construction on bridges and skyscrapers in New York in the 70s and 80s were Native American. And there's a great scene where Albert Finney literally walks up the Manhattan Bridge to like the top of one of the columns where sort of like the bulbs on top of it are, and has this great scene with Edward James Olmos where he sort of questions him about like, so can you turn into a wolf?
Could you
stop doing that?
He's like, turn into a wolf?
He goes, yeah, I swim like a fish. I fuck like a rabbit. He's like, wolf? Sure. I could do that.
Edward James Olmos is very sexual in this film, and you do see he does hang dong.
Oh,
at
you
one
see
point.
It. You see yeah. everything. You yeah. see everything.
But I love that scene because it's just so funny that Albert Finney has locked in on this, like, maybe these guys are turning into wolves. And that's like his. I mean, he's not super far. He's a little off, but he knew the guys to go talk to about this, which I guess is a point in his credit.
Because, like, yeah, he put Edward James Olmos away.
Yes.
So they have a little bit of a rapport here, which leads him to follow Edward James Olmos to, like, the bar that him and his friends hang out at. And
yes.
then, like, he follows them after they leave the bar, and like the older friend just like gives him a tab, and then he runs to Coney Island, gets completely naked, and just like starts going, not like he doesn't turn into a wolf, but he does a very convincing wolf mode.
He goes wolf mode. Yeah. He makes paw prints with his hands in the sand and howls at the moon and like attacks the water with his mouth and fully naked the whole time.
And then, like, he sort of knows Edward James. I'm sorry, he sort of knows that Albert Finney is watching him too. And then he just, like, sort of just like, hey, here I am. It's me. I'm naked.
See, I told you
I could turn into a wolf.
He's like, it's all in the mind.
And then, meanwhile, Gregory Hines is developing his own theory on this because, like, in one of the victims, like, in the first victims, like, their organs were missing. But in the second victim, like his liver was still there, and mm-hmm. he ascertains that it's because like his liver was like badly diseased and like whatever was eating him didn't want it.
Yes.
And Gregory Hines starts to put together a theory where he starts looking at like vagrants and like various like sort of destitute and forgotten people from cities all over the country that are like showing up in morgues dead and partly eaten.
And he's like, hey, this happens to a lot of people every single year.
It's sort of falling through the cracks here. I know we get like dozens of bodies through this office every day, but he's like, I have a theory. He goes like, he's like, where are these people going? He's like, well, I know now. So people are eating them. So like, yeah, like as the movie goes on, like the wolves begin to kind of assert themselves into the lives of the people investigating this case. Like there's an intelligence at work here. Like when Finney and Diane Venora travel to the South Bronx and they walk around this burned out church that's an incredible set, and like they're trying to connect the two bodies and cases, and like you see them being watched by the wolf vision, by the predator vision. And then like they take a car home, and then there's a great scene of like through the predator vision of like a wolf crossing the bridge into Manhattan.
Yes. Through the top of the like top spans kind of.
It's just fucking, it's always tourists on that fucking Brooklyn Bridge pedestrian walkway.
Exactly. Clogging it up, making TikToks. But I also love like when they're in the burned out church and it shows the reverse shot of like the wolf eyes peering down at them. It's like so shocking and scary. It's like, oh my god, that's actually like, damn, those aren't like special effects eyes.
Yes, that's
just
what's so fucking good about it. The way the light is caught in their eye, like the first time you don't really see the wolf, but like it seemed like Diane Venora like hears something upstairs and she like tries to like walk up into this rickety attic, and Albert Finney kind of like tackles her because he feels there's something wrong, and they fall down the stairs. But right at the top, you can just see like a shadow move. And you see the way the light reflected in these two ghostly eyes.
Yeah, these two yellow, like gold eyes just like looking down. It's so scary. When you first see like the wolves in their full like power, it's really is shocking to see how big a wolf can be. And just,
oh my god. has a the scene where like Finney is in front of Diane Van Ora's house and he's like he's in his car and it's raining and he's kind of half asleep. He's kind of half asleep, and then he wakes up and he sees it, like the in full like the full fucking like shadow outline of a wolf like standing on top of a wall looking down at his car. And Hesse, in my notes for that scene, I wrote, had to Google how big do wolves get?
Yes,
because
it's really shocking.
You forget, like, even among like when you think of a big dog, you think like, oh, well, like yeah, a wolf's a big dog.
Yeah,
like no, they're so much bigger than you think they are. They're huge.
They're terrifying.
They're like 6 feet long and they can weigh like over 100 pounds. Like astonishingly cool animals. And then Tom Noonan, of course, there's a great scene with Tom Noonan where he takes a little scooter trip through Central Park that doesn't go so well for him.
He has some kind of premonition, this like wolf, this animal sense where he's like, the animals are calling me. And then he goes to Central Park and he's like, hears like wolf noises. And then he's like, oh, maybe I should not be here. And then he gets literally sniped off of his moped by a wolf. it's incredible.
So yeah, like there is an intelligence at work in like the targets that these wolves are hunting.
Yes.
And so after that, like, they know that they're coming from the South Bronx. They're like the wolves of the Bronx. And Albert Finney and Gregory Hines have, there's a great scene where they go to like the burned out church and they do a stakeout where yes. they have like AR-15 with like night vision scopes and they're both looking at each other like bitching at one another.
Yeah.
Yeah.
the scopes are so comically large. It's like all you could think of was just these huge scopes.
And of course, then Hines is killed by a wolf.
Yes, it's very sad.
And like that's the first real wolf kill we see. And it's just like, once again, animal attacks are some of the hardest things to ever do in a movie. And I think this movie had a really, like, uses a really creative effect of the predator vision to, like, that's what you see pouncing on people. It's the camera, not the wolf.
Yes.
Because, you know, that's pretty hard to do. But I got, like, yeah, animal attacks are just so hard to do in movies. Like, it's hard to think of, like, maybe Green Room is the one that I think that got it the best. It was like one of the most horrifying scenes of all time.
Yes. but also, like, it's you do see, it's an amazing, like, Jurassic Park type clever girl style effect where Albert Finney goes into the basement, like, to kind of smoke these wolves out and, like, go like attack them where they live in the basement of this building, and it turns out it's just like a trap that the wolves were like luring him away from Gregory Hines, and they just like one Gregory Hines is like talking to him, and then you see behind him a wolf just like peer out from like the the ceiling. It's like, oh my god.
And like, once again, it's like, talk about movie magic. Like I know you can like kind of train a wolf, but like how do they get them to snarl like that? Like how do they control them? I guess they got the real police snipers covering them. Like I really just have to stress like how totally otherworldly and terrifying the wolves in this movie look, because they are just real wolves.
Yes.
No substitute. And then in my favorite scene in the movie is when like after his good friend Greg Hines has been killed, Finney goes, is like covered in blood and like shook.
He has the thousand yard stare.
Yeah. And he's just like, no, look, the only people who can like tell me any, there's talking any sense about this is the Edward James Olmos and his friends, like the ex Native American radicals. And he walks into their bar and it's a real like record skip moment. And everyone looks at him because he's like the white cop entering this like bar for Native American radicals. And like he sits down with Edward James Olmos, and I love this scene because Edward James Olmos just like he just spits facts at him.
Yeah, he doesn't even need to say. Albert Finney doesn't say anything. Yeah, it's just like they're called wolfen.
So you heard of wolves, right? Well, these are a little bit different. They're called wolfen, and it's the name that wolfen is the name that the like Dutch settlers gave to both like the shapes that move in the forest at night, be they wolf or human. But like the wolfen are essentially spirits. They're wolf spirits that, in his words, went underground. As wolves are being exterminated, they went underground into the new wilderness of our cities. As he says, the slums, the graveyards of your fucking species.
Yes, they feed might on be the gods. Poor. Yes.
He says, their world is older, more finished, more complete. And my favorite line in the whole movie, he goes, don't even think about believing any of this shit. It's the 20th century. We've got it all figured out. Don't even think about believing this shit. And I love, he's telling them as Albert Finney is like, yep, I absolutely believe this shit now.
Yeah. He's like, holy shit.
Because once you start believing it, there's no fucking turning back.
Yeah.
And again, this movie's focus on cities, and the urban wilderness is this idea that the wolfen they're killing that sick wino in the Bronx is that they're feeding off of the discards of our civilization.
Yes.
The people for whom in our natural order don't fit in, and they are sort of culling the herd of humanity to restore a kind of balance that our society is incapable of doing, because we discard the poor and leave them to die in the South Bronx.
Yeah. And I love that also as this is going on, there's right before it goes to that scene, there's the private security firm is doing another Waco to
yes, the Goddard Demerung, yes,
to the left wing terrorists.
So they're as Albert Finney cracks the case and learns the true ancient knowledge of the wolfen and their presence, their godlike presence among humanity, a humanity that in the 20th century doesn't want to know
yes.
about shit like this, that is incapable of seeing or even considering that such a thing could be possible, because we're the apex predator now. We have no competition.
There's a phone in my Lexus. I don't need any of this.
Yes, in New York in the 80s, the cocaine was plentiful, the money was everywhere, buildings were going up, the South Bronx is being renovated, no one wants to hear about the wolf spirits until it's too late.
You say barracuda, everyone says, huh, what? You say wolf spirit, we got a panic on our hands on the 4th of July.
Yeah. Oh, and I love that, after they do another Waco to the Goddard Demerung terrorist house, they're like, case closed, we found a wolf skin among their
sundry
terrorist items. Yeah,
we found a fursuit. This must have been what they were killed of.
They gift that poor real estate developer to death.
Yes. But then Finney goes to... What happens next? Oh, Finney's taking refuge in the
Vanderveer penthouse.
Yes, in the penthouse, and he's realizing he's mulling over everything that's happened. Then they come and tell him, "Hey, it's all over. We can all go downstairs now. It's gonna be fine." And they leave, and instantly they are surrounded by 12 wolves.
It's Venora, Finney, and the guy who plays Finney's boss, who's another great New York City stereotype. He's like, what the hell is this shit? And this scene is all filmed right on Wall Street. These are literally the wolves of Wall Street. They're on the Wall Street steps looking down at them, snarling.
Yes, it's so good.
And then Finney is like, okay, he's like, just be calm. Just don't, whatever you do, don't run. And his boss just fucking bolts.
And reaches for his gun, yeah.
Goes for his gun. Wolf takes his hand clean off.
Yes.
And then he gets in his car, stump, spurting blood.
There's an amazing part in the car where he's trying to he tries to close the door with his hand that's gone. And he's has to stop and check himself. And he's like, oh, fuck.
And in classic horror movie fashion, bleeding stump goes to try to start his car. Nope, wolf in the back seat.
Yes.
Wolf is already in the car. and then takes his head. Once again, I don't know how they do that with their jaws. It's, you know, if I'd have bone to pick with this movie, but you know what? I'm not arguing. They take his head clean off, and in a callback to the scene in like the very beginning of the movie with Gregory Hines' character, where he's discussing the severed head of the Van der Veer wife, he's like, you know, during the French Revolution, they used to pick these up, and like one out of every 10 heads would still be breathing and looking at you. When his boss's head gets taken clean off, he fucking like is just like, oh, Bob, like he's like mouthing words on the floor of on the nice cobblestone streets of Wall Street.
It's so upsetting. It's so amazing though. And then Finney and the girl get back in rush to the elevator, and there's a great little gag where the elevator won't close, and they eventually go up and like realize that the only way to win against the wolves, because they're smarter, stronger, more powerful, to just like cede the South Bronx to them and be like, hey, look, we won't mess with you. We won't tell anyone. Like,
he's got like the head wolf, this amazing all white wolf,
yes,
just staring at him and snarling, and he realizes like, yeah, this service weapon, this isn't just a regular dog. I can't just shoot this dog like I do regularly.
This isn't a dachshund in a house during a SWAT raid.
So he like he just like lower, he like puts the gun down, he drops the gun for the wolf, and then and then goes beast mode on the kind of the scale model of the condos that Van der Veer was going to build in the South Bronx, thus displacing the wolf pack from their hunting grounds. And in the beginning of the movie, you see a demolition of some building that they're going to demolish so that they can build some new appalling condos. And then like you see the predator vision, and the whole reason that they attack and kill Van der Veer and his wife is that they're competing for hunting grounds with him. He's encroaching on their territory. He's taking away. By gentrifying the Bronx, he's taking away their access to the sick and dying they need to feed on. But yeah, like so Finney is just like the one white man who can make peace with the wolves by laying down his arms and being like, we got you. You know what?
No,
the South Bronx, it's 2023. The South Bronx is still fucked up.
Not in my backyard.
We've written that off. It's all yours, wolves. Just stay away from Yankee Stadium and the tourists. But yeah, like the cops come in and they're just like, what the hell happened here? And then he's just like, terrorists, don't worry. The terrorists did this. Don't worry about it.
And then
and
he
they're
takes,
like, good enough for me.
Yeah. And the last shot is that he takes one of the last shots is he takes the fur suit, which is just a wolf pelt, and he just puts it on top of the destroyed model of the condo. Is like the wolves have destroyed. It's a beautiful bit of visual shorthand, visual symbolism.
No, I mean, I'm like the last scene are sort of wolves like running under the Brooklyn Bridge, and you can see the Manhattan skyline in the background. Like, and it's just like a voiceover about how like, you know, they're like, there are some gods like that we'll never understand, and like they're just still there, and like I don't know, I love this movie because it's like the way I love this movie for, you know, how it treats New York City of the 80s and how it like it's a metaphor for like a changing city, and like I said, like the ever-present past that can never really be buried, and like the, you know, I think utterly sympathetic portrayal of wolves. Like, wolves don't kill people. Wolfen do.
Yes.
So if you're thinking about building a new condominium in New York City, don't.
Especially if you're Dutch, because there's some bad blood between you and the wolfen.
Honestly, this is an anti-YIMBY movie.
Yes.
And that's why I like it. I am a NIMBY through and through, goddammit. If there are any YIMBYs who listen to this show, please stop now. We're sending the wolfen after you.
Yes.
But just once again, amazing, amazing wolves. And then the utterly charming Albert Finney, Gregory Hines, and Tom Noonan.
With his lunch lady hair. And yeah, it's I'd never even heard of this movie, and I was like really amazed that it was so amazing and like incredible, and I loved it. And I love the wolf vision and swoosh vision, where it's like a you know, creature view, and it's like swishing around on like a steady cam.
I had not seen this movie until fairly recently, but I'll tell you, the first time I saw it, I was blown away that like how have I never seen this movie before, because it's incredibly good. And like,
yes.
In like you know, if you like American Werewolf in London or The Howling, like, you've got to see Wolf. And even though they are not technically werewolves, they are merely wolf and wolf spirits. So the first time I watched this movie, I watched it on my laptop, attempting to sleep on some floor, or, you know, attempting to sleep on like what passes for a couch in the Denver International Airport.
Oh,
after
my God.
I was stranded there overnight.
That's a place. If there are wolfen, that place is severely haunted by them.
incorrect, Tessa. The Denver International Airport and the massive underground bases underneath it and all of the other weird shit in it was built to protect Colorado and the international airspace from wolfen.
Yes.
It was meant to trap and contain the wolfen. But yeah, if you're looking to watch a horror movie, I recommend spending the night in the Denver International Airport after you get stranded there, because Joe Brandon tried to land his plane in Southern California.
Yes. No, I love this movie.
Wolfen, let's take a quick break, and we'll be back to talk Chicago, the second city.
Have you ever heard of Candyman? And if you look in the mirror, you say his name 5 times.
In cities everywhere.
Candyman.
They whisper his name.
Right. Candyman.
It's just a story.
Candyman.
Candyman.
Just a ghost story.
Candyman.
An entire community starts attributing the daily horrors of their lives to a mythical figure.
The legend first appeared in 1890. He was attacked, mutilated, and burned to death. Poor Candyman.
Helen, a woman died in there. Leave it.
Everyone knows he isn't real.
That's modern oral folklore.
Everyone. Except Helen Lyle.
Bring it up.
It ain't safe around here.
That don't scare too easy.
Don't know about Ruthie Jean? They ain't never gonna catch him.
Who?
Candyman.
Helen.
Who is that?
I came for you.
Do I know you?
Now, she is about to discover.
Helen? Get out! Get out!
What's behind the mystery?
I'm sick.
What's behind the legend?
Listen, he's under the bed!
And most terrifying of all.
Come with me.
What's behind the mirror?
He's here.
Candyman, you don't have to believe. Just beware.
All right, we are back. All right, Hessa, before we get started on this one, I'd like you to join me in a little experiment here.
Okay. Uh-oh.
Okay, we are both looking into our computer screens, and we're looking at ourselves in
yes.
this video chat,
it's
correct?
It's a form of mirror.
Okay. Say it with me now. Candyman.
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 I got you.
Right, we'll see how this next hour goes.
Yeah.
We'll see how this next hour goes.
See what happens. I hope nothing bad happens.
So, Candyman from 1992, directed by Bernard Rose, based on a short story by Clive Barker. So, once again,
yes.
we are back in the world of gothic eroticism. And this movie certainly does not disappoint. But yeah, like, it has, it's based on a short story by Clive Barker, which dealt with the poverty of his hometown in Liverpool. And Bernard Rose was fascinated by the, like, you know, savage inequality of Chicago and decided to transpose the film there. And I guess, like, another interesting thing I like, despite that both these movies are sort of are urban horror stories, I think both of these movies are also very are interesting works of like political consciousness and genre.
Yes.
And offering like, critiques embedded in the horror genre that could fairly be described as woke.
Yes, this is a woke movie, I would say. It's pretty woke.
I mean, literally, Candyman is about a naive white academic who is punished mightily for her privilege and stupidity.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I know that, like, the Candyman was remade recently, and,
yeah,
like, all the coverage
of
it was about... Yeah, I haven't seen it either, but, like, all the coverage about it was about how new and cool and radical and woke it is. And I was like, what the fuck? Like, the original one was. What is it? The original one, how did they make it? They made it woker? What's going on here? I thought the first one was, like, a beautiful but, like, savage indictment of, like, the conditions of poverty in this country and, like, our racist history.
Yeah.
And I think all of those themes, I think, are beautifully captured in, like, the opening credit sequence of this movie, which is gorgeous. Like, but first you see, like, a totally apocalyptic vision of Chicago being, like, consumed by bees. It's sort of like the Wu-Tang video for Triumph.
Yes.
And then, like, the Chicago skyline, and it's sort of like this cloud of bees. And then we get the opening credits, which is a bird's eye view of Chicago that takes you from, like, the downtown parts of the, like, you know, the Chicago River and, like, Gold Coast to, like, the South Side, and what it traces a, like, one of the Chicago heads. You chime in here on what sort of highway the movie, like, this helicopter shot that just sort of follows. Like,
let's call it
like a model.
The James Elway Memorial Highway. What are the Blues Brothers' names? Let's call it the Blues Brothers Memorial Highway.
It's the Elwood Blues Memorial Highway.
Yes.
It's the highway they built to memorialize all the people killed in their rampage through Chicago.
Yes.
R.I.P.
R.I.P.
And then we get this haunting gothic organ score in this movie by Philip Glass.
Yeah, that was the real jump scare when I rewatched it for this episode. I was like, Philip fucking Glass did the music for this? Holy shit.
And the score in this movie is Tony Todd, who plays Candyman, said of this role and this movie. And like, much of this, I think we should just talk about Tony Todd, because, like,
yes,
this is one of my favorite horror movie performances ever.
Oh,
and
easily.
He said, I always wanted to do Phantom of the Opera. And I think that's such a good way of thinking about this movie. Like, Candyman really is a kind of modern retelling of Phantom of the Opera.
Yes.
And in his character, he has this, you know, this gothic, tragic romantic, you know, and, like, his line, be my victim. It's just, like I said, like,
yes,
it's just... it's infused with this goth eroticism, but in Bernard Rowe's movie, he introduces, because it takes place in America, in Chicago, this other huge element of race into the movie, like, in addition to poverty.
Yes.
Is it race more than class? I don't know. Let's figure it out after discussing Candyman.
Yeah.
But what I want to say about that opening credit sequence is that this bird's eye view tracking shot of the Elwood Blues Memorial Highway as it takes you from, like, the downtown parts of Chicago into its benighted and impoverished neighborhoods. And I think that's so interesting, because I always think of The Power Broker and Robert Moses and the ways in which he used highway construction as a form of, like, erecting physical barriers to segregate communities.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, like, to create the Cross Bronx Expressway, or the BQE, involved the raising of, like, all kinds of middle class multiracial neighborhoods and the creation of these, like, physical barriers between, like, the poor and black parts of the city and everywhere else.
Yes.
And I think this movie, like, right in the beginning, is, like, really showing you that harsh dividing line that, like, is there and everyone notices. Everyone sees it, everyone drives on it, but nobody thinks of it in that way. And, like, that's how I always thought about, like, I always think of The Power Broker in the opening credit sequence of this movie. And then we get the apocalyptic vision of Chicago, and then the great voiceover from Tony Todd. They will say I shed innocent blood. What's blood if not for shedding?
Yes, he's so... every line from him in this movie. My personal favorite is... When Virginia Madsen is like, I'm afraid. And he's like, of the pain or the dying. And he's like, she says, of both, and he's like, oh, the pain, I assure you, will be exquisite. I just love that line.
I mean, because it's Clive Barker, like, we see all the many parallels to Hellraiser in this movie. And like I said, in terms of its, the kind of, the beauty and the rapture of Candyman, the character, like the famous scene where the bees come out of his mouth, like, there's something kind of, like I said, there's a lushness and a beauty to it. And like I said, a kind of, a very charged eroticism in his character, and like in his sadism, or like in his quest for victims and the shedding of innocent blood. There's a real rapture in it. And the movie is, I guess, like the process of Virginia Madsen being both like terrorized by this, but also kind of transfixed seduced by Candyman. Yeah. So we talk about Virginia Madsen, like, she's the main character of the movie, and she is, and a sociologist, of course, at the University of Illinois in Chicago. And like, for part of her graduate student thesis, she is writing about urban legends. And she's like recording one of her subjects who's telling her the urban legend of Candyman. And like, we see I guess in the film, the story being told. And it's like, it's so interesting because, like, that in that retelling that Bernard Rose stages, it is very much the classic suburban horror movie trope. Yeah.
White picket fences, a bad boy in a leather jacket, cheerleader in Home Alone. Yeah. It's like, it's
and
so
like he's
good.
Coming over to get laid, and like, yes, he's like, look at your parents are away, huh? And then his date goes up to the bathroom and says Candyman 5 times into the mirror,
mm-hmm.
and then like the next thing he knows, there's just like blood seeping through the ceiling.
Yes, and yeah, she's been massacred, and his hair turns white because he's so scared.
He has been butchered.
Yeah,
but yeah, like they're both these like two white teenagers. It's like the lily white suburbs in like everywhere America, and like, you know, she's, you know, this, but this is just like an academic curiosity for you. And I like that her friend Bridget, I believe her name, is played by the same actress who plays Jodie Foster's friend in Silence of the Lambs, who helps her with the Buffalo Bill case.
Essentially, the same character.
I feel like that actress kind of got typecast after Silence of the Lambs.
Yes.
And then, of course, we've got to talk about Virginia Madsen's shithead husband, played by a character actor, I think, supremely gifted in playing horrible assholes and douchebags, the great Xander Berkeley, who you might also remember as Heat, as the guy who fucks Diane Venora in her postmodern dead tech bullshit house.
Watching my TV. You don't watch my TV.
But Xander Berkeley is another grotesque portrait of an academic. And I love that Virginia Madsen was his grad student, but they make very clear in many scenes in this movie, he is constantly courting the affection of the next crop of grad students in his urban legend class.
Yes, he's, I think the best way to describe him would be he's a drip. He's like a total, and it's like, so he's such like a, you know, piece of shit. And Virginia Madsen, who obviously was his student once and now is his wife, and then goes back to kind of, you know, goes back to his lecture and sees him eyeing a young girl the same way that he eyed her. It's very, you know, wonder what's going to happen with that later in the movie.
But, you know, we hear like little snips of his lecture. And like, I love his sort of, his college academic take. And he's like, we have to face the fact there are no alligators in the sewers. These are the unconscious reflection of the fears of urban society. And then, like, you know, the way they all just eat this shit up.
Yes.
And then Virginia Madsen's character is just like, and she's working late, and she's like, oh, one of the black cleaning ladies at the university is just like, oh, what are you working on? And she's just like, oh, nothing, just some stuff about Candyman. And they're like, oh, well, you know what? In the neighborhood I live in, he's killed like 15 people. And she's like, oh, wow. Oh, my God. I'm going to have the best thesis ever.
Yes. The like friend comes in, and she's like, tells this really horrifying story about like, how she knew a woman who, one of her friends, was kept calling the police being like, someone's digging through my wall, and then killed her with a hook, and the police never showed up. And then she's like, wow, I can't wait to use this to get a Nobel Prize.
The convention in this movie, about how, like, in apartment buildings and, like, big residential blocks, like, the apartments are so close together that, like, if you took down the medicine cabinet in your bathroom, you could see into the next door apartment is horrifying. And the Candyman murder that they investigate in Cabrini Green is, I don't think it took place in Cabrini Green, but it is based on a real murder that took place where a man entered a woman's apartment through her medicine cabinet and killed her.
Jesus, that's really upsetting. And there's a part where Virginia Madsen, like, discovers that you can literally go into the next apartment from her bathroom, from the medicine cabinet, because it was also a housing project. It's just been, like, gentrified.
Yes, yeah, and, like, and the movie is very clear, like, that the gentrified housing project that Virginia Madsen and Xander Berkeley live in, you can see the Cabrini Green Towers from their house.
Yes.
And again, like exactly like New York City, like, and then, like, perhaps, you know, even more starkly in Chicago, the way in which, like, poverty that is unimaginable to, like, white people who have gone to college is just, like, a few blocks away from where you live, and you never think about it.
Yeah.
And, like, this movie takes a really ahead of its time and really savage view of academics who have a kind of anthropological view of poverty.
Yes.
Of, like, oh, like, you know, what an interesting social phenomenon. I hope I'm not contributing to it in any way. And yeah. I think that's underscored by a scene where, like, after Virginia Madsen hears the stories of these grisly murders going on in the Cabrini Green housing projects, she's, like, at the university library scrolling through the microfiche, and she's, like, got a pen in her mouth, and she's, like, eyes wide. She's, like, wow, poverty and violence in Chicago? I'm going to blow the lid off this.
Yes, it's, like, so crazy. She's, like, you know, it stuff like this happened, like, right here all the time. And, like, you know, this building used to even be a housing project. And I love that her the decorations in her apartment are, like, you know, like, she has, like, African, like, tribal masks on the wall, and she has, like, yep, all these types, like, all
her and Xander Berkeley are a real type in this movie.
Yes, exactly. It's literally like the dad from Get Out. Like, it's like his apartment.
And then Virginia Madsen gets, like, the bright idea that, like, what's really gonna, like, you know, most of my thesis so far is just hearing these boring stories that I know are made up. So, like, I'm gonna get my friend who's black to accompany me to, like, the worst neighborhood in Chicago, and yes, we're gonna talk to real people and get their real Candyman stories about the abject poverty and violence that they live with every day.
Yeah, it's completely, like, nauseating to, like, that they would even have this idea and go try and do it like this. It's very...
This movie was filmed in the real Cabrini Green housing projects, and they were still standing. And again, once again, like, in a future narrative film, like, I mean, Michael Wadley was a documentary filmmaker, but, like, same with the absolute bombed out ruins of the South Bronx in the 80s. Like, the real Cabrini housing projects is fucking terrifying. It's awful.
Yeah,
it is. I mean, like, look, and the movie, like, look, the movie, I think, is clear to show that, like, normal, regular, everyday people live in these places. These are not all just, like, you know, depraved, you know, impoverished, violent criminals, but, like, this is just, yes, a terrible place for any human being to, like, grow up in or live in. And you know, like, it's I think the movie is very realistic about that.
Yes. Yeah, it definitely doesn't shy away from that, I don't think. And I think them going there for the first time is, like, where we get maybe the scariest scene in the movie, where she's, like, entering the hole in the wall where the Candyman purportedly, like, entered and killed the woman in her apartment. And she's taking, like, flash photos with her camera as her friend just waits in the other room. And it's very nerve-wracking.
And then we get probably the most famous shot in this movie. When she's in the Candyman apartment, she finds this kind of, like, altar of offerings to him, of, like, a pile of candy with razor blades in it. But before entering the sacrificial room, or sort of the altar to Candyman, she peers through a crack in the wall, and, like, her head is like peering through this crack, and as the camera pans out, the hole is, like, the middle of, in the mouth of this huge mural of Candyman's, like, anguished open mouth, and
yes,
it's her hair peering through the cavernous maw of this mural of Candyman. And yes. another, want to know another really obnoxious white person thing that they do in this movie is when they're walking around, like, you know, the Cabrini Green housing projects. He's just like, look at all this street art, and she's just taking like photos yes. of like of graffiti that says things like "I will like death, murder, kill you."
Yes, look at all this street art. It's so good. She's so like they're so annoying. And then like the scene after that when they go to dinner with their like. Obnoxious academic friends and she
the guy who has appointed himself the America's top candy man expert is just like yes. oh yeah, you think your thesis is going to take out my upcoming yes. upcoming book Candy Man, a new reflection on an epistemology of race in America.
Yes, it's like so, and like the way that she also thinks that she's so much above them as she's like just because like she basically went to the housing projects right before and is like, yeah, like I actually went there. I was on the ground.
He's like, yeah, like, that guy's book is bullshit. It's just interviews. He never talks to any real people like I did.
Yeah, it's like
I'm so... like, and the real person she talks to is like, you know, this like incredibly stressed out single mother who like lives next door to the apartment where the murder took place, and she like lives with her infant son and like a huge Rottweiler that's like yes. I guess like her source of protection from like all the gangs in the building she lives in.
Yeah,
but you know, she's just like lady, what the fuck are you doing here? She's like, yeah, like we called 911 about this and no one came, like yeah, why the fuck are you here? And once again, it's like I love in this movie, like, you know, and she has the kind of like condescending idea for her graduate thesis that like, oh, Candyman is like a totemic figure that the residents of Cabrini Green, like they give a name to the violence and poverty that they live with, and that they can attribute, like, you know, the horrific conditions of you know, urban decay and violence to. But like on a certain thing, like I think this movie, like I like the movie that like this movie is a horror movie that puts poverty front and center, and like the boogeyman. And I think like I think the point it's trying to convey is that like, if you're poor in America, there is always something out there that's going to get you.
Yes.
And like, it might as well be the fucking boogeyman.
Yes.
Like, it's just, you don't know where it is, but behind every corner, there's the thing that's going to happen that will either kill you or ruin your life forever.
And I think that's the ironic, like, turn of the first scene being this, like, all like white retelling in this like upper middle class suburbs of the Candyman myth, because like it's like the Candyman's not going after those people. It's the Candyman is going after, like, you know, the boogeyman doesn't actually, you know, go after the people who live in, you know, the suburbs with, you know, where everything is kind of white picket fences and everything. And it's interesting that they tell themselves the story as if he is kind of like a comfort.
Yes,
like,
yes.
No, I'm...
No. Yeah, it's like white ladies that are like, see zip ties everywhere and think they're going to be fucking abducted in yes. like a Costco parking lot.
Exactly.
Like, middle class America is like the safest quality of life, the safest, most predictable quality of life that any human beings have ever experienced on the planet. And as a result, I really think it drives white people insane.
Yes.
And they need to invent ever more baroque fantasies for how they may be killed or tortured or, you know, robbed or something. There's nothing funner than making yourself feel afraid, especially when your life is totally fucking boring.
Yes.
And one of the things about like the Candyman expert at dinner tells her like the genesis of the Candyman myth, which, as he says, dates back to the 19th century, to 1819. And the original Candyman was an artist of some repute who was the son of a slave who had been freed and later become a successful merchant. And then he became a prominent artist who was commissioned to paint a portrait of the virginal white daughter of like a city father. And they fell in love, and the daughter became pregnant. And, you know, in an act of revenge, he, like, sicked a kind of a lynch mob on Candyman, who cut his hand off and then, like, brought him to an apiary and covered him with honeycomb and had thousands and thousands of bees sting him to death while he's still alive.
Yes.
Charming story.
Yes, charming story. And I...
And they did it and then burned him to death on the lot where Cabrini Green was built.
Yes. And also, after they cut his hand off, they replaced it with a meat hook, which, if you're gonna murder a guy horribly in a way that basically guarantees that there's gonna be a ghost involved, don't give the ghost a weapon before you do it. It seems really
like stuck a toilet scrubber in his stump, yes, or something. Yes, that'd be funny.
Yeah.
So, I think Virginia Madsen is so annoyed by the douchebag professor that she takes it upon herself to go back to the Cabrini Green projects by herself.
And yeah, alone this time.
Talk to the neighbor, the lady again, who tells her you're fucking crazy for coming here alone. You know, right?
Yeah.
But, she also talks to a young kid who tells her another Candyman story, another horrible Candyman story about a mentally handicapped boy. A mentally handicapped boy who was castrated in a public bathroom right on the housing projects. And they're like, she's like, really? And he's like, yeah, that bathroom right there. And she's like, this I gotta see.
Yes,
Hessa, the bathroom scene in this movie is terrifying.
It's so scary. It's so upsetting, too. It's like, oh my God, it's so good.
Like, she walks in and there's like, how should I describe this? Shit street art on the walls?
Yes. You want her to say, look at this beautiful street art again. But it's literally written in shit on the walls and the stalls. It says, to the sweet. What does it say again? To the sweet go the sweets or something?
Yeah. And it's like sweets pointing to the sweet. And it's pointing to the last stall.
Yes.
And she sort of approaches, creaks open the door and sees a shit stained toilet filled to the brim with bees.
Yes.
Just cursing. It's a really one of the singular images in horror movies that really frees your soul.
Yeah.
And then if that wasn't bad enough, he is then accosted in the bathroom by a gang of men, one of them who says, I heard you're looking for the Candyman, bitch. And he's like, you found him. And he has a hook, and they beat her in this bedroom, badly.
Mm-hmm.
And she goes to the hospital, and then, of course, the police interview her, and they're like, Candyman's he's a neighborhood drug dealer, and she identifies him in a lineup. The police arrest him. And once again, they're like, whether it's Gutter Demerung or the local drug dealer, they're like, this is one urban myth that's in the books. We can send this one, book him. Candyman's over.
And she's I love, one of my favorite things about this movie is that it goes from her being on top of the world and then just because she's not only am
there's
I
interested in my
write,
work after I was nearly beaten to death.
Exactly. And she's and her friend is and the pictures you took with your camera, they all developed. They all came out. It's and she's like, wow, nothing can make this day go wrong. And she's walking in the parking lot.
Yes, yes, yes.
And you hear, Helen. Helen.
Helen.
Yes.
Be my victim. That was a pretty good Tony Todd I just did.
Yeah.
But she's like, wow, if I'd gotten stabbed, I could get real publishing houses interested in this book, not just university presses.
Yes.
But they're Candyman, just the local drug dealer, took on the name to scare the kids into not snitching on him. But no, enter Tony Todd.
Yeah,
we talked about in Exorcist 3, enter Brad Dourif. Enter the Dourif zone.
Yeah,
we just see Tony Todd in the parking lot. He's got this beautiful kind of fur trimmed trench coat.
Yeah,
fur trimmed leather trench coat. It's so cool. And he's he starts talking to her, and she's clearly hypnotized by him. She can't move and she can't speak.
Yeah, and her eyes are fluttering. It's total trance.
He
mode.
Says, "Helen, I came for you." And what he says is that. In her publication of her work, disproving the Candyman myth, she has compelled him to shed innocent blood. Because he says, I gain power from people's belief.
Yes.
He is a manifestation of people's belief in the urban legend. And by in her academic debunking of Candyman, she has compelled him to murder anew.
You've sown doubt among my congregation, Ellen.
Yes, his congregation.
Yes.
And his congregation are like, you know, the people in misery and fear who like who feed him, and that he consecrates the bonds of his faith through these unbelievable acts of murder.
Yes.
So she is she says, yeah, like he says, I am the writing on the wall, the whisper in the classroom, come with me. And then she sort of blacks out and she wakes up absolutely covered in blood in the apartment of the woman in the Cabrini Green Towers that she interviewed.
Yes.
She is covered in blood and her dog, her Rottweiler, has been decapitated. The woman is in an insane state of panic and attacks Virginia Madsen when she sees her, and her infant son is missing.
Yes, and the crib is soaked in blood. This is like the first time seeing this movie, if you don't know that the son is just missing, you're like, holy shit, did they really go there? Like, did they really like kill the baby? But basically, Virginia Madsen, the woman attacks Virginia Madsen, and Virginia Madsen cuts her with a knife, and then the police storm in and arrest her.
And yeah, she's like, I have no memories. I woke up in this woman's apartment covered in blood. Her child is missing. You got to believe me. I didn't do anything. And it's like, yeah, not so fun being a white lady now, is it? So yeah, she is basically accused of murder. She's like booked by the police. I think she gets out on bail. She tries to call her husband, Xander Berkeley, from booking. But for some reason, he's not at home at 3 o'clock.
I wonder why.
It's 3 a.m. and he's not home. Well, I wonder where he is. But yeah, like her life completely falls apart. She confronts him about, like, he bails her out. There's media. The media is everywhere. It's become a circus. And he says, look, I'm going to stand by you and we'll get through it. And then, like, of course, she confronts him about why he wasn't home. And he's like, don't worry. We're going to get through this, baby.
Don't worry
like,
about
as you can,
it.
As you can see him, like, okay, eyeing the exit. So, and then, while she's, like, awaiting trial or indictment, she starts going through the slides that her friend got developed for her. And she sees Candyman in the reflection of one of the mirrors standing behind her in her slide.
Yes.
And then Candyman visits her again, and he says that he has the child. Yeah, he says he has the child, and unless she comes with him, the child will die in her place. And then, like, yeah, your disbelief destroyed the faith of my congregation, so I was obliged to come. And you can restore the belief to make lovers hold themselves tighter in their rapture. Again, like, I love Candyman's. I love like a. The gothic romantic quality of Candyman. I love like the poetry of his violence and his kind of his seduction of Virginia Madsen.
He loves being Candyman. You can tell. I mean, he got a raw deal, but he's really, you know, he's grown to appreciate it over the years of being just a spooky legend.
I mean, and then, like I said, I got to talk about Tony Todd, which to me is like, will always be a legend for me. Like Candyman, probably his most iconic film role, but like, you know, you've seen him in a ton of movies like The Rock, The Crow, The Night of the Living Dead remake. Tony Todd is just like, he has such a presence and he has such a beautiful, wonderful voice. And for me, of course, we talked a little bit about with Andy Robinson in Hellraiser, who plays Garrick on Deep Space Nine. But for me, Tony Todd will always be Worf's brother Kern from Next Generation. And of course, an adult Jake Sisko in The Visitor, which if you haven't seen it, the Deep Space Nine episode, The Visitor, if you want to see a truly moving Tony Todd performance, The Visitor is one of I cry every time I see this episode. It is one of the most beautiful and heartbreaking episodes of TV I've ever seen, and it is entirely due to the performance of Tony Todd.
I love him in The Rock when he says, "I don't listen to soft ass shit." to Nicolas Cage.
Solve shit.
Yeah.
He's just like, yeah, like just a wonderful voice. I would like a Siri mod on my phone that's just Candyman talking to me.
Yeah.
Would you like me to look that up, Will?
Will. Be my victim.
It just says that every once in a while, randomly.
Whenever my phone rings from an unrecognized number, it says, be my victim. And it's like, not this time.
No.
I won't be picking up this fucking call. And by the way, listener, if you know me or don't know me, if you call my phone for any reason, that's violence.
Yeah.
If you make a phone call to me or text me, that is violence. And speaking of violence, her and Jodie Foster's friend shows up at the apartment, you know, and then Candyman kills her.
Yeah, it's a great scene where she's like knocking on the door. She's like, Helen? And Helen's inside like, oh, shit. She walks in, sees the Candyman, and boom, she's dead.
Guts her.
Yeah.
And once again, she's in a situation where she's alone, covered in blood, and wakes up next to a dead woman.
Yes. It's
and of course, but this time she wakes up in handcuffs, and it's like, straight to the loony bin for you.
Yes. It's like, all right, we're not bringing you home again.
Yeah.
But then she gets whisked away. She starts hallucinating the Candyman.
There's a great scene where she's like, she's strapped to a gurney and Tony Todd appears floating above her, you know, very, very sexual style, and says, allow me one sweet, perfect kiss, meaning my hook from your navel to your throat.
Yes.
One sweet, perfect kiss. And there's a, I love the scene with, her and the Dr. Burke, her psychiatrist in the nut house. Do you remember the guy who plays Robert Burke? He has a small part in Tim Burton's Ed Wood as the producer who he tries to sell Glenn or Glenda to.
Oh yeah! Oh my god!
And you know, it's just like he lets her know that she's actually been on Thorazine for a month.
Yeah.
And like she demands to see her attorney, and he says, like, actually I'm working on your defense, which is an insanity plea, so it would behoove you to answer my questions.
Yeah.
And like, you know, he shows her footage of himself freaking out about Candyman, and like she thinks that he is legit cracked and begins
yes.
to profess his innocence. And then, but then, of course, did she accidentally or intentionally summon Candyman?
She says, I can prove it. She says, no, 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 I can prove it. And then she looks in the mirror across the room and says, Candyman, 5 times. And then it's this amazing, like, part where nothing's happening and the psychiatrist just, like, sighs and goes, well, and then, like, he goes, like, oh! You can see that Candyman is...
It reminds me of when Ripley and Bishop get back to the Sulaco at the end of Aliens.
Yes.
And Bishop's like, not bad for a replicant. And they're like, all right, done. And then you just see Bishop jerk for a second.
Yeah.
And then just like all that milk blood just shoot out of his mouth as you see the queen. Just like her tail goes straight through his chest and rips
yeah.
him in half. Yeah. We love Bishop, folks.
We love Bishop, R.I.P.
And then the great scene of Candyman exiting through the window, like, backwards. He's just
yes.
sort of, like, whoosh, like, out the window.
The way Candyman gets around in this movie
oh,
is so
cool.
good. The whoosh out the window combined with the, you know, the hovering over her gurney. It's, like, so sick.
So, like, at this point, she breaks out of the Shut Up and Eat home and returns home to her gentrified condo.
And it's
to
been
find Xander,
yeah, it's been
Xander
gentrified
Berkeley
again.
Repainting, it's been painting the walls.
It's been double gentrified.
Yeah. And like she has been gentrified with a younger grad student
yes.
who's now moved in. I know she's been on Thorazine for a month, but holy shit, Xander Berkeley moves fast.
Yeah.
He's got the next one moving in. It hasn't
yes.
even been a month.
Repainting the walls.
It's like your wife is accused of murder. And look, I understand. It's time for a divorce.
Yeah.
But, you know, propriety's sake, man. Come on.
Yeah.
So she, you know, she sees what's going on with that. And at this point, she truly has nothing left but Candyman.
Yes. Well,
so,
she, I think in the scene where she gets home, she starts to feel a little taste of the power of, you know, being a legend. And when the girlfriend and Xander Berkeley are terrified of her.
Just please leave. I just don't hurt us. Yeah. You can take anything you want. Yeah. You can have the sectional.
Yeah. And she's, you know, she leaves. She has nothing, truly nothing. And, you know, there's only one thing to do, and it's to, you know, save the baby. You know, she's just got to go for the Candyman's thrall.
So she returns to the Candyman apartment. And she discovers further hidden apartments and recesses and attics in this space, and she sort of gets to she finds a mural depicting the what happened to Candyman, of him being murdered by the lynch mob, and this is the real Phantom of the Opera moment, where she finds not his organ per se, but this is his lair.
Yes.
You know, and I love thinking about Tony Todd is Black Phantom of the Opera in this movie.
Yes.
Of this disfigured, a man who's been physically disfigured, but also emotionally disfigured by the horror of, you know, being murdered for the, you know, loving a woman and having a child with her.
Yes.
It's just this beautiful, and this scene, this is the scene where she gives herself to him, and then yes. We get the amazing again. Once I talk about, there's no, you cannot duplicate real living things. We get the amazing scene where Tony Todd opens his trench coat and you see his rib cage and his internal organs. You see this chest cavity entirely filled with bees.
Yes. And then they start coming out of his mouth. And
then this scene where he opens his mouth and it is filled with bees, and he leans in to kiss her, and he kisses her with a mouthful of bees. Now, the famous story about this movie is that Tony Todd agreed to do this scene where they really put thousands of bees on his entire body and face, with the proviso in his contract that he would get an extra $1,000 for every time he got stung. And I think he netted about $15,000 or $20,000 out of that scene.
Oh my God.
Good for him. Just what, talk about commitment. I mean, it's just,
yeah.
Once again, we talk about such a singular image that burns itself into your brain. And I said, the horror and beauty and kind of, I don't know what to call it. It's just the kind of visual metaphor of his sick love and his tortured romantic horror. Yeah. Of just bees pouring out of his mouth, just crawling out of his open mouth and then embracing her for a kiss. It's the best of horror, in my opinion.
It's so good.
It's just he promises her that in joining him in this exquisite death, she will live forever with him.
Yes.
And it was always you, Helen. And in the mural, we see the depiction of his lover from the 19th century. It focuses in on her eyes, and it looks like Helen.
Yeah, it's the exact same face as Helen.
I forget, was he she gets away from him somehow? She still doesn't want to fully commit to being Candyman.
Yeah, no, he backs out of the deal. Oh, he's sorry, Helen.
No, he's gotta go.
Yeah.
Helen, you're a little too thirsty. Yeah. And he goes, because she wants to exchange her life for the infant. And he says, there's time for it's time for a new through sacrifice a new myth will be born.
Yes.
And she wakes up outside there's this huge bonfire that's been constructed in front of the Cabrini Green projects of garbage and just old furniture and shit like that, and she can hear the baby crying inside of it, but she has a hook. And she begins tearing through the garbage with the hook, and the residents of the projects see the hook, and they're oh, it's Candyman, and everyone comes out. And as she's crawling through this mound of garbage to find this screaming infant, they light it on fire.
Yes.
So as the flames begin to consume her and this infant in the bonfire, Candyman appears, and like, you know, he's sort of
he's like, stay, we're on the deal. Yeah, we're all gonna die here together. Big happy family.
Yeah. And basically, she, like, Virginia Madsen is saves the baby, but like crawls out of this burning garbage. Like, she stabs Candyman with like a burning stake, and he's consumed in flames. And he's like, Helen, I wasn't that into you anyway.
Yeah.
And like, she saves the infant, but like, in crawling out from underneath this burning mound of garbage, she's badly burned and dies.
She dies. All right.
But she does save the infant. Now, keep in mind that, like, in being consumed in this bonfire, Candyman says, like, it's time for, like a new legend, a new myth, a new mythology to be born. And then, like, we see at Helen's funeral, Xander Berkeley is there with the grad student. And
yeah,
I like, you kind of seen that scene, like, the new girlfriend kind of, like, already hates him because you can see what a piece of shit he is.
Yeah, and he also hates her. It's like a total mutual hate between both of them.
Like, before they lower her coffin into the grave, all of the residents, including like the woman whose infant she saved, is like leading a procession of like all the residents of Cabrini Green are coming to pay their respects to Virginia Madsen.
Yeah.
Like, she's finally got the respect of the subject she was unscrupulously mining for academic content.
Yes, exactly. Finally.
And then we get the great last scene in this movie, which is that, like, Xander Berkeley's back at home in his shitty newly painted pink apartment with you know, like, a new younger girlfriend who he hates, and he, like, you know, they've been full of mutual hate and distrust of one another, and like, he realizes his life is kind of shit, and what does he do? He goes into the bathroom and starts crying.
Yes,
like a bitch.
And he says,
about his ex,
Helen.
And he goes, Helen, 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 Helen. He says her name five times, and then she appears right behind him, and like, her, she's bald, like, her head, like, she's covered in burns.
Up. Yeah.
She's just all burnt to a crisp, and she goes, like, you know, hi. Yeah. And then, like, the new girlfriend comes in, opens the door. He's in the bathtub, gutted, fucking stem to stern, just blood everywhere. It's a great, great dead Xander Berkeley. He looks, he's just like, he looks so dumb, but it's so horrifying.
I love him. He's so good as this
I
character.
Love Xander Berkeley, yeah. And then, like, yeah, she has become the new miracle, as Candyman prophesies. And the last scene of the movie is in, like, Candyman's Phantom of the Opera type lair. The mural depicting his murder has been replaced, and it's like a new mural featuring a burned and bald Virginia Madsen emerging from the flames of this conflagration as the new miracle born, the new legend that will avenge
shitty
on
shitty shitty boyfriends and husbands everywhere who are balding.
Candy man, no, Candy woman.
Yeah, that's right. That's right, everyone.
Yeah, so, I mean, Candyman, once again, like, an urban horror movie that, like, puts the city of Chicago front and center, and just, like, similar to Wolfen, it's just, like, the past is never really past. It's no matter, like, how much you try to think otherwise or, like, live in the modern world, like, the new mirror, like, there are always new miracles out there that are, like, reaching out to us at every given moment behind, under every street lamp and honked horn and bodega.
Yes, it's beautiful. It's beautiful how spooky the cities are.
So that does it for Ghoulie Scream Set, Asa. It's been awesome.
These
are some of our best episodes of Movie Mindset. I guess, just like, looking back briefly on it, what would you say was like the scariest movie or moment from all the ones we featured thus far?
Trying to think. I think Exorcist 3 had some of the scariest moments, for sure. The hospital scene in Exorcist 3. I think, there's been a lot. I think a lot of stuff in Candyman is up there. Oh, we forgot to talk about how it's another Hook kill. The granddaddy of Hook killing movies is Candyman, truly.
And yeah, as I promised, the meat hook gets the MVP of this season.
Yes, it can't absolutely be beat. Absolutely.
It can't be beat. And yeah, like, for me, like, scariest overall is probably Exorcist 3. Actually, no. I mean, I don't know. It's a toss-up between Exorcist 3 and Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I would say scariest and best individual scene is probably the dinner scene from Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Yes, definitely.
Best performance, got to go with Brad Dourif in Exorcist 3. And then, like, funnest, most enjoyable, probably Halloween 3, Season of the Witch.
Yeah, Season of the Witch was awesome.
We just got a chance to see that in a theater with an audience, most of whom hadn't seen it before.
Yeah.
It was so much fun.
The shock that was going on during certain scenes was incredible.
And also shout out, like, you know, maybe not best performance, but probably one of my favorite performances is Dan O'Herlihy as Connell Cochran.
Yes, Connell Cochran is the ultimate, you know, evil magnate, the OG evil magnate who just wants to...
Why do I do it? Because it's a joke. And it's the best joke of all, the one on the children.
Like stealing candy from a baby. Say, that sounds like a larf.
All right. Well, Hessa, let's close the books on this spooky season and on this mini series of Movie Mindset. This has been awesome, and we will be back in 2024 with another full season 2 of Movie Mindset.
Yes. Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye. Till next time. Stay watching movies, everyone.
Stay spooky.
A thing from another world. Watch the skies. No, watch your TV set or a movie screen.
Yes.
Stay watching that.
Not your
until
laptop
we come
or
back.
Your phone.
Stay watching movies until we come back in 2024.
Yes.
Hessa, I salute you. I salute all the horror heads out there. Till next time, everybody. Bye-bye. Let's all go to the